Support for Access Utah comes from the Utah Humanities Council, enriching cultural, intellectual, and civic life by providing opportunities for all Utahns to explore life's most engaging questions and the wonders of the human experience.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and in a half an hour, or less than half an hour, at 9:30, we'll have with us Utah Governor Gary Herbert. We'd love for you to respond to the governor with your phone calls and email questions. We've already had a couple come in. We'll run those past the governor, and that'll be your opportunity to interact with Utah's governor. That's at 9:30. We'll talk about health care, the budget, immigration, education, the economy, taxes, air quality, and many other issues. That's Governor Gary Herbert in about 25 minutes. We begin the program today with a encore presentation of a Access Utah program originally broadcast a few months ago. An interesting state program based on federal funding that attempts to address the problem of childhood obesity early, in fact, in daycare. Here's that conversation.
The following interview originally aired in December of 2011.
Thanks for staying with us through the break. I'm Tom Williams. You're listening to Access Utah. National rates of childhood obesity have more than tripled in 30 years. And in Utah, nearly one in five children are at an unhealthy weight by the first grade, which of course places them at a higher risk for a whole slew of health problems. And these problems could follow them into adulthood if those habits, unhealthy habits, are locked in. Trying to combat this is a statewide effort. It is a statewide effort that is being run by Jessica Haymond, Healthy Child Care Coordinator for Utah Department of Health. It's called Top Star, Targeting Obesity in Preschool and Child Care Settings. And Jessica Haymond joins us. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
We're also joined by the director of a daycare center who's implemented this program, Imagination Time in West Point, Missy Monsi-Weiss. Is it Monsi-Weiss or Monsi-Weiss?
No, you said it right the first time. Monsi-Weiss.
Monsi-Weiss, thanks for joining us as well. Let me start with you, Jessica. Tell us a little bit about this program and the problems that you're trying to combat here. From the statistics that I quoted, and I'm quoting from an article by Kirsten Stewart in the Salt Lake Tribune, sounds like this is a problem which is increasing.
It's definitely an issue that we are experiencing nationwide. Nationally, one in three children are at an unhealthy weight by their fifth birthday. And so here in Utah, our rates are a little bit better. We have lower numbers, but it is definitely a problem that we see in low-income communities and with special populations. So what we're doing here at the state is we're implementing this program called Top Star, which you mentioned stands for Targeting Obesity in Preschool and Child Care Settings. And what we're doing specifically is we're trying to help child care providers improve their physical activity and nutrition environment. So we have a whole gamut of things that we try to do through education, and we provide resources and workshop training for the child care providers so that they can learn what they can do to improve the environment for children and improve choices for the children in the areas of physical activity and nutrition and screen time and so forth.
And I would imagine in some homes, obviously, you'd have what we might call unhealthy habits. Are there any predictors? What poorer homes would have less healthy habits? Are there any predictors you could use?
There are a lot of contributing factors that we've seen, and there's not just one or two things that contribute to childhood obesity, but it's definitely a lack of adequate nutrition, getting all your fruits and vegetables, your protein, and instead of getting that balanced nutrition, you're seeing a lot of junk food and just unhealthy foods being served to the children and then to families as well. So there's that aspect of nutrition, and then also activity. It's it's sometimes difficult when we're getting to these cold winter months to go and play outside and to get the exercise that we all need. So there's definitely components that contribute to this issue. But as far as predictors go, it's really hard to say. There's been studies that have shown certain things being linked to childhood obesity. But again, it's definitely a multifaceted issue that we face.
Let's bring in Missy Monsivais, owner of Imagination Time. Have you been seeing an increase in this problem, more kids obese or on the verge of that?
Yes, we've actually, in my daycare, I've started taking on more children. We've increased our capacity. And in the last couple of years, we've seen kids that they're coming and their pants won't even button. They're in the size they should be in, but just over a couple months, they're getting too big at home and they're not even fitting in their clothes.
So if they're starting that early, I would imagine those habits might carry over into adolescence and even adulthood.
Oh, yeah. There's children that when I start them young, I can see maybe they don't like some types of food and it takes a little trickery to get them to finally eat it. But when I take some of the older kids in, when I'm taking like kindergartners and stuff in, they're set in their ways and they would rather not eat anything all day than to eat something healthy. They will wait to go home and get junk food.
Wow. So there's an unhealthy habit. And I should say, hardly any of us is immune from this. I sample chocolates a lot more than I should, but I guess as an adult, you at least know that you should be doing other things. As a child, you're just doing probably what your parents are doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So talk a little bit about how you implemented this program at Imagination Time. It sounds like it was pretty involved, reducing television, increasing healthy snacks, and increasing activity levels. Tell us how you implemented these things.
We're initially supposed to set three goals for our program, and our goals were to cut back on television viewing, increase directed physical activity, so not just having them run around all day, but helping them work some different muscle groups specifically, and then also to take our milk to skim milk, which we had no idea at the time. The program that we were on was telling us to give them 2% milk, and we learned that that was unnecessary calories and we needed to cut them back to skim. So we set those goals, and at first it was so hard to determine when we were going to allow television. So we've actually gotten to the point where we sold the television. There's no TV in the daycare at all.
How did that work initially? I imagine, because I've gone through television withdrawal. So imagine, kids, how did that work the first few days?
They kept asking if they could watch things, and I'd have some little kids bring DVDs in the morning, and I eventually just started telling them the TV was broken. I was just saying, it's broken, we can't watch it. And we just filled it with other things. We said, well, why don't we do this instead? And I can get you some paper and we can start drawing some pictures, or we can talk about something. And when we started the program, it was during summer and I had a lot of older kids, and they just were not happy with it. They were to the point, the end of the day, they were ready to beg for television just to do anything that was not requiring them to be active. They just wanted to be zombies and sit in front of the television. And when we did exercise instead of television, because we started doing like stretching in the morning and stuff like that, I had kids crying, saying it hurt, and they didn't want to do it, and they wanted to go to bed. But after a couple months, they seem to have fun with it now, and they understand that that's just how it's going to go, and there's no getting out of it.
They've come around.
Yeah.
We were talking about a program, a state program called Top Star, targeting obesity in preschool and child care settings. And Missy Monsi-Weiss is owner of Imagination Time Daycare in West Point. We also have with us Jessica Haymond, who is Healthy Child Care Coordinator with Utah Department of Health. Let's turn back to Jessica. Other daycares that have implemented this program, I'm guessing they've had similar experiences, implemented similar programs. Maybe you could talk about some other daycares and their experiences with this.
Yeah, of course. We have about 42 child care providers participating in three local health departments. Right now, it's just a pilot program. We're hoping at the first of next year, or actually probably around February or March, we're looking to make this program available to all providers statewide. But for those that have participated up until this point, we've seen a lot of success, and we've seen a lot of changes being made in the realm of nutrition. A lot of more whole grains are being served, a lot more fruits and vegetables, like Missy was talking about, healthy alternatives to junk food. And specifically, we have 14 different facilities. That includes home, daycares, as well as centers, and actually Head Starts, that we've recognized as Top Star endorsed providers, which means that they've gone through the entire process of setting goals and achieving those goals and attending the workshops, and then we've followed up with them to see the improvement they've made. And all of those centers and homes and Head Starts have made significant changes and really made some great strides to improve their environment and writing different policies and just really making a difference in their center. So.
Missy Monsi-Weiss, I don't know what reaction you got from parents, especially at this the turning point where you told the kids the TV was broken and you had them exercise. What reaction were you getting from parents?
I did have a couple that said they didn't really feel it was necessary, and they didn't mind if their children didn't participate in physical activity. And others were very supportive and on board. We took it a little further, and we started doing field trips every week during the summer so that we could get the kids out of the house and learning things as well. And everybody was really excited about that, and some of the parents came along with us on field trips, and they've been kind of excited to see that their kids will actually eat the stuff. They've learned that spaghetti noodles don't have to be white. You can do a whole grain noodle, and their kids won't know the difference. So there's been some interesting things that have come from participating in the program.
In fact, reading Kirsten Stewart's article in Salt Lake Tribune, you've implemented Food Fridays, where you encourage children to experiment with new foods.
Yeah, that's been a lot of fun. They will always eat the food. If you make it something fun and you say that this is Food Friday and we are going to try something different, it doesn't matter what I give them on Food Friday, they will eat it. They always try it, at least. We had cactus when they came out to do the article, and everybody tried it. They all ate it, and I don't know if you've ever had it before.
Never have.
It's a little sour, kind of like a pickle.
Hmm.
And we tried it raw, and then we baked it, which it's been a thing for me and my employee as well. We have to learn how to prepare these random things that we purchase. These are things that we've never even eaten half the time. But they love it, and they always try it. They eat it and participate. So it's been a lot of fun.
Hmm. And I imagine you'd have to be a little adventurous to eat cactus with the children came along.
With that. Yeah. My employee Lisa, she got a couple pricklies in her fingers, but we took them all off, and they played and they did it, and we did. Red cactus pears, which are different, and little things like papaya and jicama. It's stuff that's in the store all the time, and the kids are walking right by it. They're not even noticing that it's there and it's available to them. But now we have kids that are going home and saying, Mom and Dad, can we buy this? I liked it. So
we turn back to Jessica Hammond. What are your hopes with a program like this? You're targeting the daycares, so for several hours a day that the children will be in these healthier settings. Some of the children will be going back home to less healthy food and activity settings. Is your hope that this will spread into the families?
Definitely, yeah, most definitely. We're hoping to instill in these children that healthy choices are fun and that they're available, and that we're hoping to make, you know, the healthy choice the easy choice. And so when they do go home and they may not be in the most healthy environment for whatever reason, that they can kind of be an advocate and, you know, encourage their parents to want to eat healthy and to get outside and go do things together as a family. And so yeah, we're definitely hoping that it'll spread into the homes, and that these children will just, at a young age, they'll learn that being healthy can be fun, and that it'll kind of instill in them at a very young age that they can be healthy for the rest of their lives.
Missy Mosey-Weiss, in today's newspaper world, the article comes out, and that's not the end of the story. There are comments, and as you well know, because you responded to those comments, some of the commenters said there's nothing wrong with TV, and pointed out that there's some good things on TV, and there's nothing wrong with some what you might call unhealthy snacks once in a while. Tell us how you responded.
I think I started my comment with, I'm offended. I was reading a lot of the things, and people were saying things about how, like, this program was going to be a harder change for the providers, and that it was forcing us to actually pay attention to the kids, and that we were probably sneaking them candy on the side just to keep them quiet. And it made me kind of sad, because I just thought, we have put so much work into this, and we've done a lot, and the directors have helped us a ton. There's been little things that they've done that I'm sure they don't even know has made a difference in our program, like giving us a book called The Two Bite Club, and we read to the kids about it, about being in the Two Bite Club, and you take two bites of everything. If you don't like it after two bites, you don't have to eat it, but you at least try it. And we have food group posters on the wall, and the kids always say, what color am I eating from? What group? And they try to get all their colors in. But when people were commenting, they were just, I felt so bad, because there is positive television programming out there, and I guarantee that when they go home, they're being exposed to that. So it's not like there's no television in their lives at all, or they're being cut off from the world and they're not getting any treats. They're getting that. They're getting that at home on their birthdays. They're getting it when they go trick-or-treating for Halloween. We're not taking everything away and making it this bland, boring society that they have to be forced to participate in. We're just making healthier choices available to them. And like Jessica was saying, you're hoping it goes into the homes and they're accepting the healthier choices over unhealthy choices, and we talk about it all the time. We say, we can eat this, and this is going to be healthy for us, and this is going to give us lots of energy, and then we can go outside, and we can play on this, and we kind of, we're trying to teach them that it's not that candy is the enemy, it's just that there are options out there that are better for them, and we're putting a lot into this, and all those comments. I invited everybody to come and see for themselves how we do things, and we've made a lot of changes. So it's been a big deal. It's not just something that we pretend to do.
It is a big thing implementing this program, and I imagine this will be going forward even after your participation in this state program ends.
definitely.
So that's Imagination Time in West Point, and Missy Monsivais is the owner. Just have about a minute left. We'll turn to Jessica Haymond. You, I think, heard you say you're trying to expand the program, and perhaps there are daycare providers who are listening to the program who would like to participate. How best to go about that?
Yeah, we have a website. It's health.utah.gov/obesity. And that's the Department of Health, their website here for the Physical Activity, Nutrition, and Obesity Program. Anyway, they can get on that website, and there will be a link to the Top Star page. All of my contact information is on that page, so they can feel free to contact me. And as well as we in the future are looking to make it, again, available to providers statewide. And so if they want to just be patient, hopefully it will be coming into their neck of the woods soon. But if they have questions now or if they are interested in contacting me, they can do so by on getting on the website and reading about the program and then contact me with any questions that they may have.
Very good. The program, again, is Top Star, targeting obesity in preschool and childcare settings. And we've been talking with Jessica Haymond, who is child care coordinator at the Utah Department of Health. Thanks so much. And we're talking also with Missy Monsivais, who is owner of Imagination Time in West Point. Any contact information you'd like to give for your business?
They can find us on Facebook, Imagination Time Child Care and Preschool, and they can call me at 801-775-0369.
Okay. Missy Monsivais from Imagination Time in West Point, thank you to you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening to Access Utah. Coming up on Access Utah, we have Governor Gary Herbert. We're very pleased to be welcoming him in just a couple of minutes, and would love to have your questions and comments for the governor via email, which you can get to us through from our website, upr.org, or a telephone, which is 800-826-1495. We'll be talking, of course, about education, the economy, whether or not we should have tax cut, the proper role of federal government versus state government, healthcare, energy issues, all that to come with Governor Gary Herbert following this break.
Now on Access Utah, a four-minute memoir recorded by USU student Demi Martinez.
Spare change. You never know what you have until it's gone. That goes for all things, really. You don't realize how nice it is to be able to buy a Mountain Dew or a candy bar just when you need a treat, or how putting $15 of gas in your car here and there is no big deal. You don't realize how nice it is until you honestly can't afford one single candy bar or have any amount of dollars to put into your car for gas. I once had a friend named Shay. This guy was not only a blue-eyed beauty, but was about as original and unique as they come. Shay was a daredevil. In fact, he was the one who taught me how to bomb my first hill on a longboard. Needless to say, this was not a success. We would both make it halfway down the hill, and our bodies would roll helplessly down the rest. I'd be walking to class, and he would always tempt me with a big can of Arnold Palmer instead of class. Of course, I couldn't resist. Shay was a class clown. He was loud and obnoxious, but so charming the teachers couldn't help but not be mad at him. He was everywhere. I would see him down the halls, and at times I would avoid him at all costs just to save myself the embarrassment. He loved to embarrass me. He would sneak up to me no matter what I was doing or who I was talking to. He would always pick me up from behind and swing me around. Secretly, I loved the embarrassment. Shay's audacious attitude towards life got him into trouble. The older we got, the scarier, more addictive habits he attained. By the age of 18, he made the decision to go to rehab because he knew he couldn't dig himself out of the hole he had dug by himself. By this time, we had grown apart, and I honestly didn't know he was even away until months in. I didn't think much of it. I still remember, word for word, the chilling phone call that I received that ordinary Sunday morning. Shay had taken his own life. This boy, who everybody knew, everybody loved, and everybody admired, was no longer there. It was nearly impossible to grasp that concept. My heart was broken. I never missed Shay's embrace in the hallway, his sincere smile and heart so much. I wanted to just sit and talk about life in general with him more than ever before. I never realized that Shay really was a great friend of mine. We shared many memories. I saw him every single day. I truly counted on Shay to always be there when I needed him most. I never regret taking the time to realize how big of an influence he has been on my life. The only thing that comes to mind every time I look back on this time in my life is the oh-so-cliché quote, "You never know what you have until it's gone." The sad truth is, this is very true. I guess the only way to realize all the truth in this statement is to actually experience losing something, rather if it's as small as no longer having spare change for a candy bar, or as big as losing a dear friend. This is Demi Martinez.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crumb Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan, now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Thanks for staying with us through the break on Access Utah today. In this part of the program, we're pleased to welcome in Utah Governor Gary Herbert. We talked to him at our live broadcast from the Capitol on the opening day of the legislature. We wanted to expand that conversation here. And Governor Herbert, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's an honor to be with you again.
We appreciate you taking some time and understand that you'll have to get going at about 10 minutes of with the busy schedule, the legislature in session. And so we appreciate you taking the time to be with us here. In your State of the State address, let's just jump right into the top two issues. And this seems to be general agreement. Republicans, Democrats, polls taken, people that... economy and education at the top of people's lists, and you described those two. I think your phrase was those two issues are joined at the hip. I wonder if you could just give us your bullet points of what you would like to see done during this session with the economy and education.
Well, as you know, I've been focused laser-like on doing everything we can to turn around the economy. And since I've been governor over these last 2.5 years, everything I've looked at has been through the lens of, will it help or hurt the economy? And we've put principles and plans in place, which we see the fruit of those efforts. As our economy is turned around, we're growing at nearly 3 times the national average. Our unemployment rate has dropped from 7.5 to 6.0, 2.5% below the national average. We are creating jobs now at the second fastest rate in America, only behind North Dakota, which is a very energy-rich state right now that's having a kind of a boom that's going on. So the good news for us is the economy is growing. But the belief is, and I believe this to be a true thing, and that is that we cannot have long-term sustained economic growth that will continue unless we have a very skilled labor force that can adapt to the demands of the marketplace today and tomorrow. And the marketplace is not just here locally either. It's not even nationally. It's global in nature. So they are joined to the hip. You cannot have success economically unless you've got a skilled, educated workforce.
I believe your budget funds growth, and there is continued growth in the student population. Does it also have increases in funding beyond funding growth?
Yes, there's $111 million in new money into public education. About $44, $45 million of it is the growth. So that's the funding of growth. There's additional programs. We need to, in fact, find better ways to do things. So we get better outcomes. We've got to be able to score higher on our ACT, SAT test scores. We've got to do better in college preparation. We've got to make sure that the individual doesn't get lost in the shuffle because they're not being tracked appropriately in class. And so we have early intervention programs for our young people at risk that are starting out in public education to hopefully get them proficiency in reading by the end of third grade. Reading is such a key, as you know, Tom, to continue your education and to have opportunities for learning. We want to make sure we have proficiency in math by the end of sixth grade. So we've got some early intervention programs, some additional things to assess that. One thing that's called adaptive testing, so the individuals can go and take a test and find their own level as the test adapts to your, in fact, information that you have and will show what your proficiency level is in comparison to the test. And you might be at the top of the class, middle of the class, but it will find out where you are so the teacher can then make adjustments on your education to help you become the best that you can be. We have college preparation now, college and career readiness assessment, which is part of a new bill sponsored by Senator Margaret Dayton called SB 10, to make sure that our people are having are ready to get into to post-high school education, college, and career preparatory programs, so we don't have to have remedial that first freshman year of college, go back and relearn everything to get up to speed. And we also have another program, which is called UtahFutures.org, which is a career counseling opportunity where it's kind of a reality check where students can go in there and say, this is the lifestyle I'd like to have. I want to have a house and a dog and two cars and a three-week vacation in the summer and whatever their lifestyle is. Well, if you're going to do that, you've got to have this kind of education to get that kind of income. And you can kind of pick your career path and make sure that you're getting the education you need that will have the practical results of giving you an income that you want to have to live upon. So those are just other things of many, but it's all related to education, and it's part of our overall goal to make sure that by 2020, that two-thirds of our adult population in the state have some kind of post-high school certification or a degree. Because if we don't do that, Tom, then our economy in Utah will underperform, and that would be a sad commentary on what we're capable of becoming. So that's why the emphasis on education, because it's joined at the hip with our economic opportunity and development and ultimately our quality of life that we have here in this state.
We're talking with Utah Governor Gary Herbert on this part of the program, and if you have a question or comment for the governor, I'd love to get that to him at 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495, or you can go to our web address, upr.org, click on Access Utah, and there's a link there to get an email through to us. We do have a couple of emails for you, Governor, which I'll summarize here just shortly.
Sure.
That's upr.org. I wonder, Governor, do you support in concept the House and Senate Democrats' plan to commit a certain dollar amount over several year period to education?
You know, I think the idea of having a plan in place that you build towards is probably a good concept. Most of us understand the importance of setting goals and planning. I'm one that believes that you have to have flexibility in the budgeting process because there's all kinds of fluctuations in the marketplace that you cannot account for. I'm not much for earmarking money and those kinds of things, and so I'd like to have the flexibility. But the idea that we need to, in fact, anticipate there's going to be growth in education because of our fast-growing state. We're the second fastest-growing state in America. We have the highest birth rate. We have the largest family sizes. So we know that we're putting 12,500 new students, that's new students, into our public education this year alone. And we would anticipate we're going to have a similar kind of number the next year. So the idea that we need to anticipate and build for that number is, I think, good counsel. And I think Republicans and Democrats alike should join in on that principle of, look, this is what it's going to take this year. We need to anticipate we're going to need another $45 million the next year to take care of the next growth spurt. And until we finally flatten out, which may happen sometime over the next decade, we need to anticipate growth in education and anticipate the ability to fund it. That's why, again, I am so focused on growing the economy, because that's where the money comes from. We grow the economy, we'll have additional monies to fund the growth in education and for some of the other needs we feel in government, like health and human services and Medicaid and transportation.
We have Governor Gary Herbert with us. He's here only for another 10 minutes, and so we'd love to have your brief call at 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495. We do have a caller, Charles and Logan. Time is short. We'll ask you to be brief, but we appreciate you calling. Thank you.
Probably the looming environmental challenge we face is from climate change, and you've taken some criticism for being in denial on that, and I just wonder if you have any comments on that.
Thank you, Charles. We'll get a response.
Well, thank you, Charles. I think my position's has somewhat been misrepresented. I do believe in climate change. I believe the climate has changed since the beginning of time. And I do believe that man has impact on its environment, and we ought to be, as stewards of the earth, good stewards of the earth, and that means we ought to make sure that we maintain good, clean air. We ought to have clean water. The impact that man has on global warming, which was what the original comments have been about, and now we've changed it to climate change, the impact that man has on that, I think, is still a little bit uncertain. And I hear more and more scientists talking about that the science is not, certain on this area, and I think that's a healthy debate in the scientific community. That being said, it doesn't matter to me. What matters is we ought to have clean air and clean water. We ought to be good stewards of the earth. We dig a hole, we ought to fill it back up. We ought to have reclamation and make sure we maintain good, pristine areas of our state and understand that this is our home and we need to take care of it. To that end, in fact, it just happens today, we will announce a new clean air initiative that we're going to announce here this afternoon that ask everybody in the state to be involved. Everybody has a responsibility. It's not just industry, and it's not just tailpipes and automobiles. It's all of us working together in a variety of different activities to make sure that our air, in fact, is clean, and we reduce the use of carbon-based fuels and opportunities that we have to find renewables. But I'm a free market person, and I believe that the marketplace will dictate winners and losers, and they do a better job than government. And I would just use the example of ethanol as an example of a false hope and a dead-end road that because of government, we've gone down, and all it's done is drive up the price of corn and has a larger carbon footprint, and it's all because of government trying to make the decisions where the marketplace was not allowed to do it. So, again, I think we have a responsibility to be good stewards of the earth, and I will make sure that we all work together to that end.
You say, Gunnar, you're going to announce particulars today?
1:30 p.m. We'll have a press conference on this very issue.
Any particulars you'd like to say here?
Well, the basics are this is a voluntary effort. We're going to set goals and have objectives we want to accomplish. And I think Utahns will step up, as we've done in the past. I was part of the Slow the Flow campaign where we had water conservation. And we were able to reduce by 20% our water consumption across this state. I think we can do the same thing with air quality. We can, in fact, find ways to conserve energy and maintain a better quality of air. The good news for all of us, and this is not as widely known, our air quality is better today than it was 20 years ago. But we're a fast-growing state, and we need to do even more. And it's not just because of health issues. It's not just because of quality of life issues. It also has to do with economic development. If we don't do that, our economy will stifle, and we will not be as economically prosperous as we can be. So this is a chance for all of us statewide to do something to improve the air quality in Utah. We're going to introduce that opportunity here this afternoon at 1:30.
1:30, we'll be tuned in. Governor, I wanted to get your response to the response from a particular couple of passages in the State of the State address. You're no doubt aware that passages in which you said, and I quote, the federal government refuses to be constrained by its proper and constitutionally limited role. It's gotten a lot of response, positive and in rebuttal. And some of the people who rebut that say that, yes, there are some problems there, but doesn't the federal government provide a lot of positive things? One thing that brings this into bold relief is Hill Air Force Base being once again possibly on the base closure and realignment committee with the defense cuts. I wonder if your response to that.
Well, I when I talk about the overreach and the constitutional limitations, you know, I hearken back to James Madison, who, one of our founding fathers, talked about the role of the federal government. The enumerated powers were a few and defined. And he talked about the powers of the state would be broad and many. Well, we've kind of gotten away from that concept. We have things upside down. Right now, the federal government is spending $3.6 trillion a year, and 40% of that's borrowed money. That ought to be a concern for all of us, that irresponsible spending that's coming out of Washington, D.C. Just in comparison, if you took the combined budgets of all 50 states, it only comes up to $1.6 trillion. So the federal government's, again, few and defined powers are outspending by over double what the combined spending of the states are. That indicates a problem to me. I think there's a number of incidences where there's an overreach. Even President Obama in his State of the State talked about overregulation and talked about the need to go out there and develop more natural gas. Hey, I said, hallelujah, amen. That's Utah. We have opportunities with new technology and in very environmentally sensitive ways to develop much more natural gas in the Uinta Basin and other parts of Utah. But regulations are getting in the way that are so onerous and so much of a delay that private venture capital is saying, we're not going to stay in Utah anymore. We work for years upon years upon years. Don't get permits. Don't enable us to drill. We're going to go to North Dakota, where it's all private land. We're going to go to Texas, where it's private land, or Oklahoma, where it's private land. We're not going to invest in Utah on the public land. Well, that's foolish. Utah has an opportunity to help the nation provide energy and meet the demands that we have not only here in this country to help us be sustainable energy, but help us to get off the energy demands we have in the Middle East, which are causing instability in the world. So that overreach is something that we who's for overreach? You know, I'm not anti-federal government. I'm not anti-government. I'm saying that what government we ought to have ought to be in its proper role, and ought to be effective and efficient in that role. National Defense, Hill Air Force Base, Republicans, Democrats alike understand that's a proper role. But when we have a nationalized, one-size-fits-all health care that violates the Constitution, and with the individual mandate violating Article 1, Section 8, I think that we've got a concern there of an overreach. When we have regulations get in the way of the private sector and the free market system, we ought to have a concern there. So that's all we're talking about. Again, the federal government and states ought to be partners, but we ought not to be a subservient partner to the federal government. We ought to be co-equal.
I wonder what your view, if any, that you'd like to express is on Representative Ken Ivory's. It fits into this this whole debate. Ken Ivory is apparently going to run a bill challenging the federal government's ownership of land in Utah.
Well, it's an intriguing concept, and I've heard about this since way back in the 90s when I was a county commissioner working with a lot of our rural county commissioners on rural areas. It's a big concern for us because we have a state that has so much public land. People just assume that's the way it was designed to be, but that's not what the Constitution says. The Constitution never provided a provision for the federal government to really own private land. They had a Washington, D.C. and military bases, and they certainly have the ability to acquire real estate, but not to just assume real estate as states were incorporated. And in fact, part of our incorporation as a state in 1896 was the provision that land that was not privately owned at the time, that those open spaces would be given to the federal government for the purpose of disposal. They were going to dispose of the land and put it into private hands. And what Ken is arguing, and it's an historical fact, they never did do that. They never disposed of it. They've just kept ownership of it, and that's why we have nearly 70% of our land mass that's now owned by the Bureau of Land Management, because they never disposed of it. And so I think what Ken is saying is, hey, you've never fulfilled your part of the bargain when we became a state, and so it's time for you to either fulfill that part of the bargain or give some compensation to the state. So that's the argument, and it's intellectually honest, and it's an historical fact. I'm sure that, you know, there's going to be a challenge that would happen in a court case, and who knows what that'll lead to. But clearly, we are at a disadvantage compared to other states. In fact, the public land issue doesn't come into play till you really get here to the Intermountain West. From the East Coast to here to Colorado and Utah, virtually every state has only about 2 or 3% public land. The rest of it is all private. So they've treated us different. And under the equal footing doctrine, people like Ken Ivory and others, which I agree, say, you know, we haven't been treated the same as other states, and that's not right. That's not fair. And maybe there ought to be some adjustment made by the federal government. It hurts us when it comes to funding education. It hurts us when it comes to developing commercially. We can't tax it. We get what's called PILT payments, payments in lieu of taxes, which is like getting 5 cents on the dollar.
Governor, we are at time. I wonder if you could stay one more minute. We have an email that I'd like you to respond to.
Sure, you bet.
This is an email that came in last week. We solicited emails in prospect of our broadcast from the Capitol. This came in not for the program, but Larry, I'll summarize it quickly. He says his wife and he are snowbirds. They're retired. They own a winter home in southern Utah. There are others in that same boat, and they would like the legislature consider repealing the law requiring non-residents to pay a much higher property tax on second homes. They say that's unfair and that they would potentially pump that money, if it was a lower tax rate, into the economy. Your response to that, Governor?
Well, I think any time we can adjust taxes and lower them, that's probably better for the public. And but at the end of the day, we also need to pay the bills, the cost of running government. And we're a very efficient government in the state of Utah. In fact, on my watch, we've reduced our number of state employees. And as you all know, government is very labor-intensive. We have about 22,000 employees, but you have to go back to the year 2000 to find a number smaller than that. We've gone from one state employee for 113 residents in 2000 till today. We have one state employee for 139 residents. So we're a lot more effective and efficient than we've ever been probably in our state's history in delivering services, but it still costs money. And the question is there anything that's fair? We have progressive taxes on income tax where the rich pay more percentage-wise in this country. We have property taxes that are based on valuation, and sometimes the valuation of a home could be very high in a commercial district where the house resides, and so they pay a higher tax even though they don't have the ability to pay the tax. It's a little harder. It has nothing to do with their income. So taxes are not necessarily always fair, and secondary homes are ones where government has said we need to extract the money somehow. We want to make sure we protect the home ownership of your primary residence, and so they actually give you a deduction. So your taxes on all real estate are based on a certain rate based on the times the value of your home. If you happen to use it as your primary residence, they'll give you a cut. They'll give you a reduction. And so it's not that they're charging you more for the secondary home, it's that they charge you less for your primary residence. But that's been a debate. You know, we have areas in St. George and where our snowbirds go, or that could be up in Park City, a lot of secondary homes up there, and up in Bear Lake area, a lot of places where we have secondary homes, and that's not an uncommon lament. But it's a matter of what is the best formula. What's the fairest formula? We're always seeking that. We don't have one that's ideal, but they clearly in Utah believe that home ownership for your primary residence deserves a break, and that's why you get a reduction on your home.
Very good. I know you have to get going, Governor. Governor Gary Herbert has been our guest on Access Utah. Appreciate that very much. Thank you, Governor.
Thank you. Invite me back. I'd love to do it again.
Okay, we will.
All right. Thanks,
thank
Tom.
You. Governor Herbert, our guest. Coming up following a break, we're going to conclude the program, a brief conversation about an initiative that would allow and encourage Utah classrooms and students to switch to open source online textbooks. This would be cheaper and easier to update. That's a program that's ongoing. We'll have that after the break. By the way, I mentioned Representative Ivory's bill, and we'll have a program based on that on Thursday, first half of the program. Representative Ivory will be on to talk about his bill challenging the federal government's ownership of land in Utah. Representative Joel Briscoe will be the Democrat who will rebut that, and your questions and comments will be welcome. That's coming up on Thursday. More following the break.
Support for coverage of the Utah Legislature comes from USU's Department of Journalism and Communication, dedicated to free expression and mutual understanding in the information age. Online at usu.edu/journalism.
Support for legislative coverage comes from USU's Department of History, committed to providing the knowledge necessary for informed decision-making by citizens of Utah, the United States, and the world, and supporting UPR's coverage of the Utah Legislature. Online at usu.edu/history.
And we conclude the program with conversation about open source online textbooks. This is an item in the news that caught my eye, and we want to have a brief conversation about this. It'll be a little bit briefer. We went a little longer with the governor. I hope our guests will understand. We'll just get the facts out there. Sydney Dixon, the Utah State Office of Education, head of teaching and learning, joins us. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And we're also joined by Diana Sudreth from the Utah State Office of Education, a teaching and learning specialist. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
And let me start with you, Sydney Dixon. This is an attempt to make textbooks cheaper, and I guess this would be easier to update. This is open source online textbooks. Tell us in brief about this program.
Well, indeed, one of the benefits will be less expensive, but we also like the notion that if these textbooks can be printed off that a student can actually engage with the text so they can do a close reading, write in the margins, make notes, think about what they're reading, make sense of it rather than a traditional textbook where you would not allow kids to highlight and write in the books because they would need to be reused. So the use of the text and being able to use that as well as the cost is beneficial. The online textbooks, however, will also be interactive, so it allows for a student to engage with video, with models, with a variety of interactive applications as they're reading the text to make sense of what they're reading. And then the flexibility, as you've mentioned, makes a difference as well.
Dana Sudreth, apparently there have been some pilot programs, success there?
We have had some pilot programs in science in Nebo School District where they have developed a couple of texts and been using them for a few years now, and they are showing success. They've been keeping research on it, and so we're very hopeful that as we expand to mathematics and language arts, we'll have the same kind of success.
Sydney Dixon, back to you. One concern might be, are these fully vetted? They're fully reliable? I guess something about having that in your hand and from a regular publisher kind of gives it that imprimatur of credibility. These are at the same level?
Yes, I think that's a very valid and important question, and these sources will be vetted and created by experts in the field, so university professors, experts in the content, specialists in the content, so the same type of writing and vetting that goes into a traditional textbook.
And Dana Sudreth, I expect that this is the way students maybe nowadays are used to learning, that interactivity.
Well, I don't know if that's how they're used to learning because our schools are still very traditional, but we know that it's an area that they're interested in engaging. And so we think that the online textbooks will be more engaging for students. And then as Sid talked about earlier, it's also an opportunity for them to really engage with material in a more interactive way, even when it's in print, by underlining, by writing in their books, by tabbing things, and really being able to dig in deeply with their content.
Sydney Dixon, you're hoping that all school districts adopt this soon?
Well, as they get developed and we roll them out, they will be available to all districts. We vet them through the state office, and then districts have the opportunity to use those.
And will this be a lower cost?
Overall, yes. Mm-hmm. And as we mentioned, or as you mentioned earlier, even printing them off, if they choose to print the text, they can do that for less than $5, and then the open source is free to the schools.
Very good. We are out of time. Just a very quick look at this. Very interesting. Utah classrooms may still be making a switch to open source online textbooks. They're cheaper and easier to update. We've been talking with Sydney Dixon, Utah State Ed's Office of Education, Head of Teaching and Learning. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
And Dana Sudreth, Utah State Office of Education, Teaching and Learning Specialist. Thanks.
Thank you.
And no doubt we'll keep an eye on this and do a fuller program on this later on. Thanks so much. By the way, coming up tomorrow, we'll have a full hour on a nuclear power plant that is proposed for southern eastern Utah area near the town of Green River. And in the first part of the program, we'll be talking with Reed Searle, Senior Vice President for Business Development for Blue Castle Holdings. They're the company proposing this plant. In the second half of the program, Matt Pacenza from Heal, Utah, Policy Director there. That group opposes that nuclear power plant. Do tune in tomorrow, and we'll look for your questions and comments via phone and email. Access Utah Today, thanks for listening.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.